Hi, I'm Katie Lauer. Let me tell you a story. I met John Hartford in 1975 at Betty Blake's house in Mount Adams. The steamboat Delta Queen was still docked in Cincinnati in those years, and John had come up from Nashville to get in some extra hours toward his pilot's license. Betty, who was the PR director for the Delta Queen, was having a party for her son's 16th birthday in her front yard, and she had hired my band to entertain. I knew who John was, of course. His song Gentle on My Mind had shot to the top of the charts and was one of the top five elevator songs in history. I was riding all the time when I did that, he told me. He tipped his derby hat down over his face and said I'd put on my pants with one hand so I could write and get dressed at the same time. John was also a musician. His album Mark Twang had won a Grammy that year, 1975. As a performer, he was a triple threat. He played both the fiddle and banjo and sang in a clear, smooth baritone. At his personal appearances, he drove the crowds wild. Women screamed and threw undergarments at the stage when he played. He was whipped thin and dark-haired. Something about his long upper lip made him look intense, a little like an old-fashioned matinee idol. He wore a short vest, jeans, a t-shirt, two-toned shoes, and the derby hat, of course. I first saw him tap dance in my yellow kitchen in East Walnut Hills on one of his trips to Cincinnati. I was poaching eggs when he informed me that he had been taking lessons from a dance teacher, and he demonstrated how he could do one thing with his feet and another with his hands, like rubbing your stomach with one hand and patting yourself on the head with the other. From then on, he danced on an electrically amplified wooden board and played his fiddle at the same time on stage. John had brought musicians to Betty Blake's party, too, and as soon as dinner was over, all the instruments came out of their cases and the music began. We played Soldier's Joy and 2 o'clock in the Morning and anything by Flat and Scruggs. As it got darker, the moon came up and you could hear the high drone of cicadas in the humid night air. I was the only girl playing, but John didn't really notice me until I sang. I was still in my 20s then, and my voice could do anything I wanted it to do. So instead of playing Pike County Breakdown, John started summoning up old-time country numbers, like Honky Tonk Angels, with lyrics ranging from sad to tragic, and with a nod of his head, he'd indicate to me that I was to sing. I came up with one old song I didn't think anyone would know, but it was my favorite. It was titled That's Why I'm Walking, and it was just written for a Patsy Cline-type vocalist who sang with her heart in her throat. John and I were the only two musicians who knew it, and our eyes locked when we started in to play. With an old love on your mind, life ain't worth living, I sang, as John drew on the fiddle bow, his eyes meeting mine. When you find someone who knows your favorite song, it's kind of an instant attraction. Out of all the songs in the whole world that he could have loved, he had picked the song I had chosen to keep in my secret heart. I was overwhelmed. I headed toward the closed door, which was the bathroom, and when I looked in the mirror, I saw that my cheeks were pink and warm. When I leaned in to put on lipstick, I looked up and saw myself entering a new reality, stepping over a new threshold. It was just like in the movies. I was in Betty Blake's house, singing with John Hartford, and because of an old country song I didn't think anyone else would know, I had made a new friend. Of course, I was naive, but that memory in my cigar box of experiences has earned interest over the years and still makes me smile when I think of it. That very night, John asked me to accompany him and 13 other musicians on a cruise on the Delta Queen. Flying to St. Louis and boarding the Queen to travel down to Louisville, Kentucky. I was so young that I can barely recognize myself in the pictures I have of that trip. There I was standing next to John, my hair a mop of dark curls, my t-shirt tie-dyed. In another shot, I'm doing some fancy rhythm guitar with the banjo player Doug Dillard. I met another man on that trip named Harry Radel, who was an Austrian photographer, or photojournalist as they called it then. I suppose you'd call him paparazzi now. He was with Black Star, a respected agency in New York, and he had made his name taking pictures of the beatniks. He had penetrated the 50s culture, making portraits with his camera of the likes of Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac. He was older, and I stood in the moonlight with him by the paddle wheel while he talked of his wife who had come from China. "She smells like winds across the Gobi Desert," he said, with a heavy European accent, and I swooned. Harry told me Americans did not appreciate romance. If you have an assignation, you must put a bushel of oranges in your bed the week before, then remove them. Just the scent of orange blossoms lingers to make your night memorable. It was too romantic. I couldn't wait to tell the guys in the band what he had said. When I did, they looked at me gravely, then howled with laughter. I figured they were just jealous. On our last night on the boat, we stayed up all night playing. I thought that probably such a night had never occurred in the history of music. We played so long that Doug Dillard's hands swelled until he couldn't get his banjo picks off, so we kept on playing. In between songs, we could hear the paddle wheel turning and the sound of water lapping against the side of the boat. By daybreak, we were exhausted, running on fumes. But dawn on the water was so beautiful that we played a little longer, watching the pink sky split the waves. At daybreak, the passengers began to come in for breakfast, and they smiled with delight when they saw us standing outside the dining room. They thought we had gotten up at dawn to play just for them. Many years later, when John got sick, the news traveled up and down the river like a whisper. When I learned that he was seriously ill, I began calling him in Nashville every few days, then every day. His wife Marie told me, "The young people have him now. They're learning how to say goodbye. They want to do it their way." Her voice sounded strained and weary. Young string bands from all over the southeastern mountains were coming to sing him through his illness. They'd camp outside his bedroom window and play soft music until he slept. Then they'd clean up whatever litter they were responsible for and leave. Eventually, he and his mattress were moved outside to the bluff overlooking the river, and steamboats blew their whistles as they floated past like gaily painted ladies on their way to someplace special. I went to Nashville for the funeral, of course. The first person I met outside John's house was Hoot Hester, the main fiddle player at the Grand Ole Opry. And then I was engulfed in a crowd of people mingling between the kitchen, where Marie was standing with her back against the cabinet, and the living room. John and Marie had built their house in a Victorian style. The top floor was a replica of a riverboat pilot's cabin with a shortwave radio, which John used to keep in touch with the boats that passed the house. He had a picture of Captain Fred Way on the wall and copies of the journal The Inland Waterways in neat stacks on the shelves, side by side with transcriptions he had made of Ed Haley's fiddle tunes. I made my way to the parlor where John was laid out in an open casket. It was late spring, but already hot and humid, as Tennessee can get, and there was a sticky, sweet smell in the room like overripe fruit. "Goodbye, old friend," I said to the body in front of me, and made my way to the front room, where I sat down with Pete Kuykendall and Earl Scruggs. Earl told us that he had come to see John and played Home Sweet Home for him on the banjo. John beckoned him to come closer and play it again, and Earl did. We talked of other things, of Earl Taylor, a Cincinnati mandolin player who had worked for a while with Flatt and Scruggs. Earl had a slow and thoughtful way of talking. "I love to hear him singing tenor on Salty Dog Blues," he said softly. But he couldn't read at all, so he wasn't much good on a record session. Eventually, we were all called outside, and I was impressed with the size of the property. I'd never known John had a swimming pool all the times I'd been there, but somehow I still couldn't picture him in a Speedo. It was so hot, the air shimmered. Guests were under a tent in the yard, out of the glare of the sun, but I sat with the musicians in the back, under the shade of a large tree. I remember seeing Emmylou Harris standing around a microphone with Gillian Welch and David Rawlings. Gillian was sobbing, and Emmylou handed her a Kleenex as casually as she might have wiped the face of a small child. I saw Jerry Douglas and his wife Jill, who insisted I come back with them to spend the night, but I was too emotional to do that. I saw Tim O'Brien, who reminded me he had slept on my living room couch when he was traveling around with Lost John Hutchison. Peter Rowan was there and was tuning up his guitar, getting ready to sing. And of course there was Keith Case, who had been John's longtime manager. Later, the women's choir from a nearby church marched slowly up the bluff from the riverbank, singing "I'll Fly Away," just as they had done in the movie "O Brother, Where Art Thou?" And the crowd stood up and sang with them. "I'll fly away, O glory, I'll fly away. When I die, hallelujah, by and by, I'll fly away." It was an emotional moment. The pallbearers carried the casket to one of the six long white limousines in the driveway, just like the six white horses of the old blues songs. John would not have ignored that detail if he had had anything to do with planning the occasion. I thought that now I could say I had attended a real Nashville funeral. So I found Harold Kennedy's van and got in. I had ridden down with him. I found I was feeling rather fragile, and Harold and I tuned in a radio station, stopped and put gas in the car. Then I got some peanut butter crackers and a banana, and Harold and I left Nashville. We passed the Shoney's, where absolutely everybody takes meetings, found the entrance to I-65, and pointed our way true north, headed home again. For Around Cincinnati, I'm Katie Lauer.
Where does an old-time riverman go after he's passed away? Does his soul still keep a watch on the deep for the rest of the river days? Does he then come back as a channel cat, or the wasps that light on the wheel, or the birds that fly through a summer sky, or the fish swimming under the keel? Where does an old-time pilot go after he stood his last watch? Does he fall by the ear of the man who steers, saying, "Hold her on that notch"? There's a gentle sneeze in the river breeze, saying, "Son, I'm a-going to bed." Then they light their pipes and go off in the night. Or was it fireflies instead? Where does an old-time engineer go after he's cooled her down. Gone up the hill to never come back from a quiet side of town. Does a soul live on in the engine's song while the striker checks the gear? Is he still afloat on an old steamboat after he's gone from here?
Thank you very much.